Good afternoon and welcome to this edition of Very Important Information. My name is John Githongo, publisher of The Elephant.
I'm Mwalimu Mati, ex-publisher, Mouse Group Kenya, joining you from Machakos, Kenya.
And I'm in Nairobi, Kenya. Good afternoon, Mwalimu.
Good afternoon.
And Happy New Year. Happy New Year.
Yeah, to you too, John.
Yeah, how's the New Year treating you? I mean, I was struck by the regular polls that are done at the end of every year by TIFA and InfoTrack, who are our premier polling organizations in Kenya, and seem to indicate that public sentiment about the future, about prospects, especially economic prospects, was much worse in 2023 than it was in 2022.
Yeah, I get that sense too. You know, really, we're looking at a population that sounds more and more despondent, particularly amongst the youth. And, you know, some of the data coming out of these surveys, like InfoTrack, for example, says that there's also a particularly strong negative sentiment amongst women. Up to 64% of women don't feel that next year is going to be any better than 2023 was. And 7 out of 10 the post-teens, so 18 to 25-year-olds, are also very, very negative. Questions are, why? You know, what is it? And I suspect it's the economics.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that in both polls, they all indicate that at least when people compare 2022 and 2023, 2023 was worse. Sentiment about last year was worse amongst Kenyans, largely as a result of just very difficult economic conditions. And but TIFA, while saying that 2023 was worse than 2022, they say, well, they're hopeful about, you know, this year, 2024, which perhaps is. You mentioned this, you know, one of the big things about the elections in 2022 was the fact that many young people didn't show up to vote. I mean, of those who registered to vote. And especially in this key category, I mean, you know, Kenyans below the age of 30 make up about 70%, 75% of our population.
That's right. It's true. I mean, if you look at the, you know, the results, and if you're prepared to accept them, you'd say that the two leading candidates got 7 million votes each. But we actually had 19 million registered voters. So where's that? Where are those 5 million who didn't turn up? Mm. 5 million, you know, every year our voters register should grow by about a million anyway. So you're actually talking about, you know, 5 years of lost registration. From the previous election. Because, you know, the thing is, if this cohort doesn't vote, and yet they are the job seekers or the early startup entrepreneurs, and they've got this sort of negative opt-out attitude, you know, this portends some danger to the stability of this country because of their numbers.
We're talking about, they're called the Zoomers, Generation Z. And born between 1997 and 2012, between the ages of 11 and 26.
Right.
You know, when it's put like that, these are young people who, you know, who grew up in a very particular time, and that may inform their attitude. I don't know what you think.
Well, I mean, certainly. I mean, if you're saying that somebody's an 11-year-old today, that means they were born just as Uhuru Kenyatta takes over. Yeah. And Uhuru, of course, was taking over after a fairly interesting presidency of Mwai Kibaki, who you worked for.
Yes.
Which, to a certain extent, stabilized our macroeconomics, but then polarized our politics. But when it stabilized our macroeconomics, it provided for the first time to the common Mwananchi all sorts of things. I mean, the technology that went into people's hands over those years, access to credit, which was for the first time people didn't have a bank account or able to borrow money from, you know, Safaricom, you know, it's Fuliza or Mshwari, all these things kick in. So a Zuma, even the youngest, will have access to, you know, certain modcons that all their predecessors never had. And that was supportable only by this stability of our macroeconomics.
Yeah.
Now, 10 years later, we're in this uncertain time, and some of those little toys may be taken away from them. And I think that's why they're getting upset.
You know, it's interesting because, I mean, 2007, 2008, this financial crisis in the West takes place. They respond to it and drive down interest rates. So governments, I think, are across the developing world, whether it's in Africa, Latin America, Asia, you know, went on this massive borrowing binge because it was cheap. It was easy to borrow money. And you had the Chinese with the Belt and Road Initiative. So the credit was available. So whether it was euro bonds that everybody sort of rushed, you know, rushed out and got themselves a euro bond, massive Chinese loans. And I think they helped bridge a very significant infrastructure gap in particular. So whether it's roads, bridges, railways, like the SGR here in Kenya, I think the Kenya government and other governments in developing countries were able to pull off some of the large scale, very expensive projects, especially around infrastructure that they'd only been planning to do since the 60s and 70s, which I think is a good thing. But yeah. The good times have ended, and so at you know, talk about global macroeconomics. That cheap capital is gone, and we are now all staring at, you know, fiscal distress. One way or the other.
Yeah, I find there's also another curious sort of angle to the discussion about these projects. I mean, I get a sense that the younger generation don't understand sovereign debt and how it is not that easy to disavow it. It's not that you just walk away from it because you say, I didn't approve of the project. We are a country within a community of nations which have accepted certain financial rules, and sovereign debt being, you know, an immutable promise.
Yes.
It's something that I don't get a sense when I listen to some of our friends talking about odious debt and saying that maybe we should just refuse to pay. Can't pay, won't pay. It really doesn't work. And I think the youth are probably being encouraged to believe that you can walk away from certain things which you can't. And that is taking away a lot of energy from focusing on what can we do as a country to actually sort out our debt problems, but also hold certain people to account for, you know, their policy mistakes or even you know, the mischievous mistakes that were made.
I mean, it's also a generation that lives, engages in the public space via social media. They are, you know, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and of course, the, you know, ubiquitous WhatsApp that we all use to plan family events, funerals, weddings, etc. So they're living a very different life from the one that you and I know and remember. And one of the things that strikes me is in the 90s, starting in the 80s, really, our generation, we were structurally adjusted when the government at the time, in the late 80s, President Moi's government implemented a significant structural adjustment program, liberalization of the economy, selling off public parastatals, etc., and I just basically reducing the size of the private sector, and I think it reducing the size of the public sector, which I think made, you know, some of the dynamism that we enjoy today. Emerges out of some of those changes in the 1990s. However, you know, when you're looking at them as a, you know, a sovereign nation, then yeah, you meditate on them. But our current generation there's a sense of bewilderment that one feels,
yes,
you know, regarding what's happening now. Today, it's not called structural adjustment. Today, it's called fiscal consolidation.
That's right.
They like these unsuspicious terms.
But it's more or less the same thing. It's the government should get out of business, and services should be provided at cost, at minimum, if any, by the government. And finally, that everybody should pay their fair share of taxes. So I have a 26-year-old nephew who is just in his third year of employment. All my conversations with him are about taxation. And a young man who should be enjoying his life is continuously sounding like some sort of conservative or Republican, sort of fiscal conservative.
Yes.
This is a political education that we didn't have. You see, our experiences were very much based on human rights and democratic freedoms.
Yes.
When it happened, it was happening to a generation ahead of us. They're the ones who were sent home some golden handshakes from the civil service. But there was a sense that because we were still dealing with the human rights and democratic freedoms, there was a movement, a change that still continued, even if we didn't really appreciate that the economics of it is important.
Yeah.
And perhaps 20 years after the new constitution, we probably are, well, sorry, 10 or 14 years after the new constitution, we probably are seeing for the first time a marriage between those two progressive movements, economic reform and political reform. You need to now be an expert in both because there are implications for both sides. And so for the first time, you'll see certain human rights groups starting to talk about economics, and likewise the economic think tanks starting to talk about political
rights
stuff.
Freedoms. Yeah, it was possible to, you know, to have a career, at least for us in civil society, focused exclusively on issues of rights and issues of corruption.
That's right.
Now that conversation quickly melts together with a conversation about economic rights, about, you know, what are the implications of, I mean, one of the things that has emerged, which is interesting, and see how this conversation will deepen and become more sophisticated, is that the government has announced all the parastatals it wants to sell off. I was struck by quite intense debate on social media, largely, and also some in the mainstream media, about the sale of the Kenya Seed Company. I mean, Kenya Seed.
Also quite fascinated by that discussion, because, you know, a lot of people are like, hang on. We also have genetic intellectual property. I suppose that's what it's called.
Correct.
And, so there is a sophistication. You're quite right in the way people are analyzing some stated government policies.
But if, I mean, despite this greater awareness of political and economic rights in this younger generation, the Zoomers, the Gen Zs, they checked out of the last election in numbers that we've never seen before. In a sense, our generation was privileged to vote. When we, you know, multi-party elections in 1992, we stood in the sun for hours quietly.
Right.
1997, yeah. The same. But that's now 30 years now. Maybe for this generation, you know, one of the conversations that I find quite interesting amongst those who, you know, promoters of democracy, sort of democracy activists, for lack of a better word, and I was listening to sort of a Professor Francis Fukuyama's, I think, his first big interview in 2024,
yes.
And I found him surprisingly pessimistic about the fate of democracy. In this year, I think more human beings are going into elections in 2024 than any other
time right.
in human history, you know, participating in. There's going to be more elections than
that's 2024. Right.
And yet now people are acknowledging that in many parts of the world where countries have implemented, you know, democratic models of governing themselves, democracy isn't developing, isn't delivering.
Delivering.
and in particular, it's not delivering public goods like, you know, economic growth, health, education, in a manner that is fair and equitable. And I find that fascinating. And elections themselves, which are the sort of, for us, elections were democracy, you know, the ability to have kind of freedoms.
Practice was the thing, yeah.
Exactly, but now
and so we're getting caught at the end of that sort of cycle by realization that you know, Kenya might be a pro forma democracy, you know, so how does that benefit us? You know, we're having split decision elections, margins of 100,000 votes.
Yes.
No real political party development. So we're actually running coalitions, electoral based coalitions, clash.
Yes.
But they're so evenly split that whoever wins will be unpopular with the other half of the country. And maybe that also adds to this sense that government can't solve problems. But then I think I remember you saying once that sometimes government acts as if the problems that the Zoomers are facing, including economics, has something to do with the Zoomers rather than with the government.
Yeah.
So you just need to save more, and then you'll be able to buy a house.
Correct.
You need to pay more tax.
You need to be, you know, a better steward of your resources. You're actually doing really well, and you're complaining too much. You should work harder, save more, and everything will be okay.
That's right.
And from the sentiments that we see in all these polls, clearly the Zoomers don't believe that. But what's fascinating to me is that their angst and their disillusionment is not only a phenomenon. I mean, we're seeing it here in Kenya. We're feeling it here in Kenya. I see it a lot on social media, but it's also apparent very much in the West. Even in the big democracies that we have always, you know, ideologically looked up to in a sense. But they're having the same kind of sense of disillusionment with the whole system.
Yeah, yeah. And that is sort of a fertile ground for, you know, all sorts of demagogues to appear and start telling this massive part of our population. And I do find that sometimes I think we're talking about them as if they're abstract, but these are our brothers and sisters and our nephews. It really is their country, so they need to also start to develop the ability not to lose hope, because troughs in the nation's development will always be there. There's also going to be ages of prosperity. It's just to try and mediate the swing between, you know, high and low.
Yes.
And I think maybe the reason why people be feeling so bad is that they probably thought in 2021 that everything was very smooth sailing.
Yes.
They weren't aware of some fundamentals, which I think are now coming into play, including sort of debt redemptions, which we didn't have to do for about 10 years.
Well, I mean, ironically, 2024, the year of, you know, all these elections around the world, you know, I think about 15 elections, I was counting, around 15 elections in Africa alone. I think today, as we're having this conversation, is an election in Comoros, and it's a small sort of set of islands just off our east coast of
yes.
North Africa. And I think that this profound sense that, you know, democracy isn't delivering is something that we're going to have to face up to at the time when especially our Eurobond debt across the continent is coming due. This year. So, you know, it's hard to tell people, okay, yeah, you are checking out of the political process at the time when, unfortunately, things in the short term are going to get considerably worse. One of the effects that has really struck me has been, as we've seen this wrath of coups and coup attempts, especially across the Sahel region. I mean, from the west coast of Africa to the East Coast now, it's, you know, these are now countries that are run by military dictators of one sort or the other. These fellows seem to enjoy widespread popular support amongst young people.
Yes.
At least on African social media, they seem to enjoy widespread popular support. There's an exhaustion with corrupt governments, unaccountable governments, and a sense that, yeah, democracy isn't delivering, so let these soldiers try. I think for our generation, that's a lot more frightening because we've seen that, you know,
we remember the 60s, the 70s, you know, I mean, it starts out with some fairly probably high-minded guys in the 60s overthrowing the Ghanaian government, perhaps. But, you know, it degenerated up to Idi Amin, and there is an interesting thing. But you see, these, if they are like Sankara, Thomas Sankara, that's one thing. But, if they're more like Amin, then you have to worry.
So, well, one of the striking things about this wrath of coups over the last several years has been that many of those young guys, soldiers who are taking over, seem to be modeling themselves around Thomas Sankara Burkina Faso. And yes, he's an icon now. And you can't call him an icon of democracy, no, because he took over by a coup. But he's seen as an honest leader who wanted the best for his country, a true African patriot in every sense of the word. And so he's, you know, he's Africa's Che Guevara in many, many ways. And so he's, you know, his photograph is sort of bandied about by the younger generation who were not alive when he was running Burkina Faso. You know, as a very esteemed figure. And they seem to be modeling themselves around Sankara.
I think there is a reemergence of the whole discussion of new colonialism, structural neocolonialism, even if it's not overt, some structural links with our sort of metropolitan masters. But I would hope that, you know, if I were to be asked about my hope for next year, is some form of a deeper public education or discussion about the options. There are no easy fixes to our current situation, and there are no messiahs that are going to appear. Mm. Just to start being a bit more skeptical about what politicians say are the solutions, and then engage in the next finance act, which should be published anytime now as a bill. Some sort of public mobilization to push the idea that there is no ruling class in this country. There is not meant to be. These are essentially our servants who we should be giving instructions to. So it's probably getting some movement around encouraging whatever civil society or popular sort of organizations are forming to call for, you know, more accountability from particularly from Parliament. Yeah. Particularly from Parliament, because, you know, there is this assumption that the executive is the one that's raising taxes, but in fact it's Parliament that is voting the taxes without taking care of the people they were sent to represent. So actually the fault is largely in Parliament. The executive can always want things, but Parliament is supposed to put the brake on it.
I mean, one of the striking things about the last couple of decades has been the extent to which the executive overshadows Parliament in such an absolute way. You know, I think you and I remember a time when parliamentary committees, the hearings of the Public Accounts Committee, the Public Investments Committee, you know, were important events in terms of the making and interrogation of public policy. And that's kind of changed somewhat. So again, I go back to the word that you used, we're in a pro forma situation, even with regard to certain key institutions that should not be pro forma. They are
they're meant to be part of a rigorous checks and balances between arms of our government. I mean, I truly believe that, the executive, even if I didn't vote for it, is my government. But they need to be held to account. Their policy needs to be mediated by parliament and by the courts. There is no way that you can have any functioning government if one decides that it's about...
I think it's the creativity that is required of those who are doing quote-unquote 21st century civic education, not only in Kenya, but across Africa, to a generation like this 70 to 75% of Kenya that is of below the age of 35, that has lost faith in elections, in democracy, in politicians, in institutions. Again, that's mirrored across the world. Is how to get them to re-engage. Otherwise, this proposition that the Sahel, the young people in the Sahel seem to be going for, unfortunately, may become much more common. And I think, unfortunately, that is likely going to be the case, in 2024, partly because of the dislocations around the fiscal distress that the continent is in. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It all starts with, you have to line up in the sun and vote. Take that vote, and when elections come around, vote. It gives you a stake that is not available to you in your own imagination otherwise. Great. Well, Mwalimu, I mean, we've touched on a whole range of issues. Our time is up.
It's a pity we'll do this again sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thanks.